Coming up on Digital Music Trends 192, recorded on the 16th of July 2014, who knew that copyright could be so thrilling, as we cover consent decrees, the Department of Justice, alleged collusions and more. Also on the show, the Fair Digital Deals Declaration by Win, Rhapsody on Radio, Soundwave introduces a major update, SoundCloud's a rumored equity deal with the majors, and some big news from Pono. Hello everyone, and welcome to Digital Music Trends. I'm Andrea Leonelli, and this is the weekly show where we talk about and try to make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry. And DMT is available as a video and audio show on a variety of channels, including the iTunes Store, most podcatching apps, YouTube, SoundCloud, Mixcloud, Spreaker, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and many more. So if you'd like to receive a weekly newsletter about the latest show that have come out, please do visit bit.ly/DMTlist or digitalmusictrends.com and sign up right there. And this week it's a real pleasure to start the show with three amazing guests. So first up, it's a pleasure to welcome Andrew Dober to the show, director of at Music Tech Fest and professor of music industry innovation at Birmingham City University. So hi Andrew, and thanks for joining us. How's it going?
It's going very well. Thanks for having me along.
It's great to have you. And it's also great to welcome to the show Eric McKay, Managing Director at My Media Insider and former VP of International Business Affairs and Business Development at Vivo. So hi Eric, and thanks for coming on. How's it going?
Yeah, really good. Sorry you had to read out so much in terms of my title. It was always a horrific one to have to say publicly.
I practice it. It's okay. I did it on stage last year, so I think I can manage it in the comfort of my own room. It's fine.
I did a lot of things on stage last year that I don't want to repeat now.
And joining us for the first part of the show, it's a real pleasure to welcome back Paul Fackler, a copyright lawyer and partner at Aaron Fox LLP. So hi, Paul, and thanks for joining us. So where are you based?
Right now, I'm based out of my home for the day. I'm not in the New York City office, but New York City Aaron Fox office, generally speaking.
Perfect. And so this week, we are going to open the show by talking about rights. Please don't switch off specifically. We're going to talk about the U.S. saga involving publishers, rate courts, the Department of Justice, withdrawal threats, and collusion investigations. So I hope I've made it more interesting now that I've phrased it like this. So two main pieces of news here. So first of all, the chairman of Sony ATV, Martin Bandier, last Friday in a letter to his songwriters, threatened to pull out of ASCAP and BMI altogether should the current review by the DOJ not meet the publisher's demand. So the DOJ is currently reviewing the rates, essentially, that companies like Pandora are paying to publishers. And the second piece of news is that DOJ has sent out something that's called a CID, which is a civil investigative demand for documents, to ASCAP, BMI, Sony ATV Music Publishing, and Universal Music Publishing Group in connection with a review of the consent decrees that ASCAP and BMI operate under. So Billboard reported that these actually are a bit of a double-edged sword, because the CID request may be used as part of an inquiry on the coordination between the publishers and ASCAP while they were dealing with Pandora, for example. And this inquiry actually originated a few months back from Judge Denise Coates' judgment on the case of the rates between ASCAP and Pandora. So, Paul, I want to start by looking at the second news. So have the publishers gotten more than they could chew, or more than they bargained for by getting the Department of Justice involved? And what do you think the DOJ is looking for specifically when looking at these coordination issues?
Well, I do think this is a classic case of unintended backfire,
right?
in connection with the major publishers' strategies to try to get out from under rate court regulation here in the United States for performance rights. No question they did not want this to go this way. There's no question that the spin that you're starting to hear from ASCAP and BMI about how wonderful this is, and it means that the Department of Justice is going to give them what they want. I don't know. You'd have to be pretty delusional to read this as good news, the latest development as far as the subpoenas. I don't think it should be a surprise if you go back in time and read Judge Coates' decision in the Pandora case. That case, you talk about rights being a fairly dry and boring topic. That decision reads like a Martin Scorsese film.
Right.
Okay. If you read that actual decision, and it's not a question of Judge Coates interpreting the evidence and making inferences. She's quoting the actual testimony and documents from the music publishers. Okay. And it was pretty damning because the whole purpose behind that attempt to partially withdraw selectively some of their rights, or really not, that's not even an accurate way of framing it, partially withdrawing their rights only for certain types of licensees, right, namely digital music licensees, right? So that they could discriminate against them and use their market power in these direct negotiations. That was their whole strategy behind that. So it shouldn't be surprising that as soon as they thought they accomplished that move, they immediately went out and started behaving like monopolists, which is what they are. So that decision from Judge Cope had very specific examples of,
right,
you can only call it collusion, and she called it collusion, between Sony ATV, Universal, through ASCAP. And of course, the major publishers sit on the board of ASCAP. That's the only reason that this thing happened, this partial withdrawal,
yeah,
which is not only bad for the marketplace, but it's also bad for songwriters. That if you read Judge Coates' decision, there's plenty of evidence that songwriters were dead set against this.
Right.
Because ASCAP at least has some measure of transparency and the direct payments going to songwriters. Maybe transparency isn't a good word, but at least the payments, once it goes through the black box, goes directly to the songwriters so that the publishers can't hide money in their accounting systems and take all of their wonderful deductions that they've invented to keep as much of the money as possible.
So essentially, it sounds like even if the DOJ was to review the way things are handled and the publishers could go out and strike direct deals on the digital side, major publishers may actually face tougher regulatory scrutiny. And in that sense, they wouldn't be able to present themselves in the same way as maybe they did last year when they were negotiating the deals with Pandora.
Well, yeah, that's part of the problem, is you got to be careful what you ask for, because you just might get it,
yeah,
okay? ASCAP and BMI have been making their bumper sticker argument is that the world has changed. These are archaic consent decrees from World War II, and they don't make sense in the digital world. Now, they don't say what it is about the digital world that suddenly makes the consent decrees unnecessary, right?
Yeah.
They never say that. The market power and the monopoly issues, the antitrust concerns, are all just, they're worse today, as a matter of fact, than they were back in 1940s when the industry was much less concentrated and
right,
consolidated. And I think one of the differences when the DOJ looks into this is going to be precisely what you said, that if you look at a major music publisher today, the way that they operate, they're essentially mini PROs because they've aggregated a vast catalog of rights. In many instances, they don't own the copyrights. You know, a lot of times they do admin deals now,
yeah,
co-publishing deals. So in both a legal way and in a practical way, in the way that they function, they're very much like PROs, and they have absolute market power. If you are a digital music service that needs a blanket license, see, the problem is the nature of the blanket license,
yeah,
which,
yeah, sure,
is, which means you get one license for an entire catalog and you pay one price, and it doesn't matter which songs you play, because if you're programming music channels, that's what you need. There's no way to like clear the rights on a song by song basis. It just can't function that way.
Yeah, sure.
But that is that the nature of that license is what creates the inherent competitive problems. And that's why the Department of Justice got involved right when these blanket licenses were first invented back in the 1940s.
Absolutely. And so I'm really interested, Eric, in hearing your thoughts, because of course you worked in business development at a service that required essentially licenses to operate. And so you dealt a lot with collection societies through the years. And what are your thoughts around these issues that are happening in the US and around the possibility of major publishers, becoming disentangled from collection societies and actually, a digital service having to go directly to them to get the catalog?
Well, I think I'm in a very strange way kind of lucky that I've seen both sides of this.
Right.
So obviously I was at Vivo, I was negotiating against the publishers, but beforehand, and people that have known me for quite some time will remember when I was the big bad wolf at Selas, licensing EMI Publishing's rights on a pan-European basis.
Right.
So we were the ones that basically screwed up Europe, apparently. And this is basically a problem we've had, and we've been dealing with it since 2008. And now I will always have some form of sympathy for the publishers in this situation, because especially in the US, if you look at how the rights flow, you've got the labels collect the mechanical rights and decide to pay a portion if they want publishers at some point, and the publishers have to rely on their audit trails to be able to claim underpayments, and it takes forever to get paid. And then they have no power to negotiate rates and be commercial with services from the performing rights side.
Yeah.
So they're kind of sitting there as this kind of impotent bank, not really doing that much. And I say that with love because, you know, they're my people. Impotent people, not bankers. And I just think it's, they're trying to replicate to a degree the control they have in Europe. They've seen a huge increase in revenues from being able to license direct. They've been able to see services like Spotify go from strength to strength. You know, I think there's still an issue with people trying to license general entertainment directly. You know, the publishers haven't quite got that one down yet because it's a much different market. But to be able to rely on something from 1941 that gives them like 1.8% of revenue guaranteed, it's just so antiquated. And I completely agree with Paul's position. You know, they obviously don't want to license everything on a track by track basis, but I think Marty's position threatening to pull it is a really strong negotiation tactic. And, you know, from a service point of view, like Vivo, you know, Vivo relies on various different licenses to be able to operate in the way it does. And I think there's a flexibility that does exist in the US market that makes it possible. So, you know, services like Pandora are able to exist, whereas Pandora can't exist in markets like the UK because the rates are too high. But, you know, I think this is going to play out for quite some time because Marty's not going to let it go. You know, Marty wanted to buy EMI. He didn't let that go until he bought it.
Absolutely. And Andrew, so from your end, looking at this from a sort of an academic perspective and also from your perspective as the director of Music Tech Fest, what do you make of these controversies? You know, of course, you don't have a direct stake in these negotiations. So from an outsider's view, what do you see?
Everybody has a direct stake in these sorts of negotiations.
Well, yeah.
Because, you know, it's one of those things that, and it's not just the people who are kind of rattling sabers or having their noses put out of joint or potentially aren't going to earn enough money or are going to pay too much money or whatever it happens to be. Because, and I'm saying this with my academic hat on rather than with my Music Tech Fest hat on, because Music Tech Fest is about a creation of new types of instruments and new types of experiences of music. But what it kind of feeds into is the idea, and to a large extent, this is probably going to be unpopular with your audience here, but I don't really care. Because what I'm interested in as somebody who studies these things is how music makes meaning for people, how music contributes to society, how it enriches culture, how it does all those sorts of things. And people sort of arguing about how much of the slice of the pie that they can get from a financial point of view is a conversation that dominates all of these discussions.
Yeah, but the
and
problem,
I want to be the guy in the but I want to be the guy in the corner waving a flag and going, it's actually more than just about who gets paid this week. It's something that actually is enriching our lives, and it's not just people making products and selling them in a marketplace. And so from that point of view, the kind of the posturing on this, which does go back and forth, which dominates all of the political and public discourse about this, overlooks the fact that most of the people for whom music is really, really important aren't being considered. And so these kind of, this is where copyright comes from, though, of course. You know, what is copyright trying to achieve is how do we make society better? How do we make culture better? How do we enrich the kind of the wealth of ideas and you know, the useful sciences is kind of the phrase, all those sorts of things. Nobody is talking about that stuff. Nobody cares about that stuff. All they're going is, how can I spend less money or make more money? And so the whole purpose of all of these discussions is buried in this kind of very instrumental thing about where's the cash?
But the problem, in fact, is that, you know, you were talking about the fact that everybody's talking about the money, but also it's a case that if certain parts of catalogs are being withdrawn because of these monetary negotiations going on, then that also affects the end user tremendously, because then you can only access certain types of music in certain types of way, in certain types of scenarios.
I mean, this is completely tip of the iceberg stuff, because actually massive portions of catalogs are already being withheld from the public. I would say, I mean, the kind of the best estimates are 90 to 95% of everything that's ever been released by the major record labels is currently not available for sale in any way, shape or form, because they don't know who owns the rights. They don't know who the songwriter is, or they don't know what the contracts are, or they don't even know what they've got in a large extent. So there are masses and masses and masses of tapes in vaults that are decaying, that can't be digitized and released to the public because it's in nobody's economic interest to do that. Now, from my point of view, that's nonsense. And so somebody withholding catalog that is already in the marketplace, that's a very, very small problem in comparison to the massive, overwhelming majority of music that is not available to anybody.
It's a very interesting perspective. And Paul, I wanted to sort of ask you a second question before I let you go. And that was all about Sony ATV's right to withdraw those tracks, in the sense that we've seen Martin Mandir make this statement. Of course, this is more of a positioning from Sony ATV, because they may be able to do that. The problem is that, for example, the MMF, the Music Managers Forum in the UK, today issued a statement where it pointed out that Sony ATV may not actually have the right to withdraw many of the works in its catalogue by non-US writers, because those writers have likely retained control over the allocation of their performance rights, even though the publisher shares in the revenue. So where such writers have then appointed a non-US society to administer the performance rights, that society, you know, then would still be tied to ASCAP and VMI in order to collect the money that they have. So, you know, what do you make of it? Do you think that the threat of Sony ATV is feasible, also given that these publishers don't really have an amazing database of what they own and what the situation is around their rights?
Look, this is a classic bully move. Marty Bandier is a classic bully. If you look at the way Sony ATV behaved in the Pandora decision, they behaved as classic bullies, okay? And what does a classic bully do when they're not getting their way? First, they threaten to punch you in the nose, and then if that doesn't work, they say, I'm going to take my toys and go home, okay? The letter, he knows, first of all, in the songwriting community, they're very up in arms about this idea of having the licensing taken away from ASCAP and put into Sony ATV. As someone whose firm represents songwriters and heirs, God forbid you ever have to do an audit of any right. of these, you know, especially Sony ATV and now EMI, okay? I've never heard of an audit that showed that the songwriters were properly paid or even close, okay? So there's a good reason that the songwriters are against this too, okay? But really, as a practical matter, Sony has no way to bring the licensing function in. Now, the courts have already ruled that they can't play this game of taking it out just for the ones they can beat up in a negotiation and leave it in with respect to radio, TV, bars. Is Sony ATV really going to go around to every bar
exactly, yeah.
and do all that licensing? There's just no chance. So anybody who really knows how this licensing works knows that it's a silly threat. It's posturing because he's trying to scare the DOJ. He thinks he can bully the DOJ. Well, we saw how that went.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure the DOJ knows how it works, right?
Yeah, and this letter that he sent out to the songwriters, which was really designed for everybody else to read, right?
Yeah.
This letter, he's made this threat before. I mean, we just had roundtables. The Copyright Office held a series of public roundtables on music licensing reform. I was there, you know, testifying on behalf of certain clients. All the publishers, ASCAP, BMI was there. Sony ATV was there. They've been making these threats for – in fact, they made these threats in order to bully ASCAP into changing the rules so they could do that partial withdrawal in the first place. And – you know, so they've been making these threats for an awful long time.
Yeah.
This, in a sense, this letter is nothing new. And I don't think it's very realistic. It would certainly be madness. I mean, I'm not saying they wouldn't try to do it, I guess, but it would be madness because there's nothing in place right now that could take the place of what ASCAP and BMI do for a Sony ATV. And in my view, you know, going back to the discussion before about looking at what's going to come out of this DOJ review, there's just as much of a chance as if they did do it, however they did it, whether it's through Sony in-house or whether they create some new entity, they're going to wind up under regulatory control anyway.
Yeah.
Ultimately, they have to, because if you look at what happened, you know, in the Pandora rates going up, up, and up, you know, at least here in the States. And, I, you know, look, I'm sympathetic to songwriters, too. Maybe you can't tell it from what I've just been saying. I'm very sympathetic to the artists who actually make this stuff, okay? But there are bigger – the problem is in the United States, no digital streaming service has ever been profitable on a long-term basis, ever. So ultimately, there has to be – the problem, of course, is the record labels are getting paid so much at such high rates here in the United States that it's strangling the whole industry. But the answer is not – the music publishers are like, oh, the record companies are getting 60-70% of revenue. We want that too. Okay, well, get out your calculator or your abacus or whatever you want to use. If it's the digital world, if you want to use the antiquated consent decree, which, by the way, has been amended dozens of times since 1941. So this idea that it's this thing from 1941 that's never changed, it's just factually untrue, but it's a bumper sticker they like to use.
Yeah.
So you know, that's the real challenge there. I think that threat has backfired, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah, and Eric, I mean, I'm sure, you know, we all did the maths in our heads. I looked up I couldn't find the 2013 earnings from ASCAP, but the 2012 showed that, you know, ASCAP earned just over $900 million between U.S. and overseas incomes and had about $100 million of operating costs. And, you know, I just can't imagine Sony having the kind of investment power behind it to be able to invest millions and millions and millions of dollars just creating an infrastructure, as Paul was saying, to track these rights if it was to pull out. So, I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, you've technically got an infrastructure in place already in Europe. You know, yes, the digital stuff is only a smaller part of it, and they would have this massive, massive issue trying to license bars, cinemas, all these kind of different things that become very difficult. But the infrastructure is there already, and if you're telling me that if they walked up to another society somewhere else in the world and said, we'll give you all these rights if you take this, if you take it on, there's infrastructure everywhere to do it. Whether or not regulatory they could have access to the US market from abroad is a very different thing, but the infrastructure is there. It's just how they make it work in practice, because, you know, somebody's always going to want to make money out of this industry, and there's always going to be someone standing behind the people that are currently making it.
Yeah, absolutely. And Andrew, anything to add on this?
Well, just that the idea that the infrastructure is there, it's an equally broken infrastructure everywhere. I mean, as Paul kind of alluded
to earlier.
I didn't
say it worked.
Yeah. but the idea of something that was an alternative that was transparent, that counted every play, that actually paid the artists whose music was performed in all instances. I mean, and the idea that close to, you know, 12% of all of the money collected from these revenues is on administration is nonsense today. The idea that it would cost millions and millions to track and trace all of these plays. I mean, this is with my kind of championing the innovator's hat on. Sorry, I'm getting calls that are interrupting. I'm hoping that's I don't know if you're getting me, but I'm getting calls that are interrupting, and I'm trying to bump them off. But the point that I'm making is with my kind of championing the innovator's hats on, I'm sure there's a way that if the PROs gave it some thought, that you could design a system that counted every single play of every single work, that accounted for it, and that made sure that everybody got paid, rather than the large publishers sort of aggregating the bits that you can't really count or that are a bit tricky or a bit costly to find. You can solve those problems now, and nobody's incentivized to, or at least not the people in charge of making sure it happens. And that's, I think, the disruptive change that needs to happen. We need something that's transparent. We need something that can count every single play of every white label record in a nightclub and make sure that everybody who wrote songs gets paid that money. And at the moment, the whole system is set up to prevent that from happening. And that's the real problem at stake here.
Right. A very, very interesting issue. And Paul, it was an absolute pleasure having you on, and you definitely shone a light on some of the issues that I definitely couldn't elaborate on further. So thanks so much for joining us. And again, Aaron Fox, it's aaronfox.com if people want to go and check out the firm.
Absolutely.
Perfect. And thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
So we're going to continue the show by talking about the Worldwide Independent Network. So there's been an interesting development yesterday and today, which is the fact that the Worldwide Independent Network, which is called WIN, and we discussed this to no end in the last few weeks, given their stance on YouTube, has announced a new Fair Digital Deals Declaration. So they essentially made up this declaration, which is, and they also announced that today was going to be the Worldwide Declaration Signing Day, which is going to be open to labels of all shapes and sizes. So what does this consist of? So essentially what they've done is created a framework of pledges, I guess, that labels are taking by signing this that ensure that artists are treated fairly. So some of the points that they make is, we will ensure that artists' share of download and streaming revenues is clearly explained in recording agreements and royalty statements in a reasonable summary form. Also, they pledge to account grant to artists a good faith pro rata share of any revenues and other compensation from digital services that stem from the monetization of recordings but are not attributed to specific recordings or performances, and so on and so forth. There's five key points here. And so the press release, of course, invites both majors and independents to join, but given also the point that I just read about the pro rata share of any revenues, even those outside of specific revenues that are trackable to a sound recording, it's unlikely that we're going to see majors actually sign for this. I wanted to ask your thoughts. What do you make of these this Fair Digital Deals Declaration, and also of Wynn's role, I guess, which is really taking a leap over the next over the last few weeks from being an organization that was very little known and very obscure in a sense, to being an organization that is at the forefront of the independent sector practically worldwide. Andrea, any thoughts on that?
Well, I think these things are always pieces of communication. And so the expectation right. that all things are going to sign up to it and people are going to get involved is almost secondary to the point that we are raising this issue and we're kind of bringing it to people's attention. And the kind of the invitation to get the majors to join in on that is very much a please write about this because this is important.
Yeah.
And so as a piece of public relations and as a piece of communication, this is a very successful kind of act. And it almost doesn't matter what happens next.
Right.
And it seems to be this kind of series of really important issues that get raised within the public consciousness about what things are important when we talk about music, what things are important when we talk about who's at stake and whose livings are at stake and whose sort of art is at stake and whose benefit is there. So as, like I say, as a piece of communication, as a piece of sort of exchange of meaning, there is something really interesting going on here for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And the initiative is supported by Flurry's social media activity as well. They have a Twitter account called @WinForMusic and a very long hashtag if you want to go and check it out and check the tweets. It's called #FairDigitalDeal4 as a number artists. And the declaration has already had 700 plus signatures as well. So Eric, from your perspective, do you think that, because this comes sort of just a few weeks after Wynn made a big declaration around YouTube and took a stance on YouTube's behavior with independence, do you think this is in any way relatable to that? Is it a completely separate initiative, or does it essentially echo a need for independence to show that there needs to be more transparency in the industry as to what is happening on deals?
All these things, I think, are always going to be interlinked. The YouTube situation, when it really kicked off kind of at the end of May, I thought it was a really interesting move from kind of Wynn and Merlin to just call them out publicly, because Google as an entity are, and I've said it so many times in the past, they're really good at kind of throwing their weight around to get what they want, and they're not used to people saying no to them. It happened before on YouTube many years ago with Warner's basically going, well, screw you, we're taking our content down, until they got a better deal out of it. And I think that the indies have really kind of, they've all got on the same page now, and they realize that they can't be pushed over anymore. And I, the likes of Emmanuel de Buretel from Because, signing up to the declaration today, I think is really, really good. The bit about the pro rata revenue splits, I think they're going to struggle. I'm not going to lie. I think that's insanity to think anybody's going to agree to it. But I think as kind of really solid kind of lines in the sand, it's a really good starting point. And like you say, they've got 700 signatures, well, over 700 signatures already. And it's a groundswell that needed to happen. Rara got into hot water with Merlin a while back when they decided to launch the service without actually getting any of the indie content. And it's just, I think it's now a really good thing, as Dubbo says, to just really say to people, you as a consumer of music, you love what we do. How bad would you feel if our stuff wasn't there? You need to be aware of this. And it's just a really nice press story. I was watching it unfold this morning, and just, I think it's a great thing to do, but I just wonder if all of the points are actually going to be actionable.
The flip side of that, though, of course, is and you're right, this is a really good kind of important statement to make about the value of creators' work and all that sort of thing. But when you get to the point of, well, how would you feel if we took our music away? Everybody would just go, we'd listen to all the other music. We're not going to run out of music. There's no shortage. And if you took your record away, maybe I wouldn't get to hear your record. Maybe I'd miss out on something really good. But I'm not going to be short of other good things to listen to. So as a kind of a, again, this is, I'm going to take my ball and go, home thing, that's actually quite an unhelpful thing. But engaging in the space and going, you know, well, actually, you know, you value what I do, not in the sense that you know, you would suffer if I took it away, but in the sense that together we create something that's of value, I think that's a really important thing to bring to people's attention. But as soon as you sort of start waving the stick around instead of just the carrot, you start to run into problems with audiences and go, you know what, I've actually got lots of music to listen to.
Absolutely. And I mean, let's take it from a perspective of also somebody that is looking to sign to a major. I mean, if you look at, for example, a new artist and they have an offer from a large independent and an offer from a major label, the independent has signed this declaration day. If we look at a declaration, if we put aside the press and that aspect, do you think it could actually make a difference to an artist's decision to go with a label or another, given their stance on trying to be more, you know, equitable?
I think there's so many different things that come into play when an artist decides who they're going to sign to and how they engage with the industry as a whole, or if they even bother to engage with the industry as a whole. You know, there's so many ways of people just doing their own thing. I know it's a really old thing, but like Amanda Palmer, she just kind of stuck two fingers up, probably pulled her pants down at the same time, and just went, I'm doing this my way because that's what I can do, because my audience has given me the ability to do it. And I think the idea of going, oh, I've got a deal from a major on a table, should I take that, is so old-fashioned. You know, you have like an Ariana Grande who, you know, a billion tweets in a day. Yeah. Things like that are amazing. But the amount of artists that sign to majors for huge amounts of money and just like fall on their ass when actually they probably would have done better on independent, you know, you don't know who they are because they're the unspoken masses.
They're the 95% of artists signed to major record labels who aren't getting pushed, aren't getting promoted, who aren't, you know, their records aren't doing anything. But it's one of those things that in most cases, as soon as you're being chased by a major record label, you don't need them. And it's proof of that. And so it's a catch-22. But that's not to say that you can't use that to your benefit, if, you know, because there are people who are really good at marketing. There are people who are really good at kind of managing certain things that you might not be good at. But you've got the choice now, obviously, to do different things.
Yeah.
But it does very much depend on what the artist wants to do. I mean, there have been lots of these kind of fair trade music type initiatives on the internet, and people sort of doing stuff that's about, we demand these sorts of things in order for this to be equitable and fair, and everybody should kite mark their record label with these sorts of policies. And not everybody does. In fact, hardly anybody does. And people kind of work it out. So it's, you know, horses for courses, really.
Yeah, and it's an interesting story. We'll definitely keep an eye on it. And I'm sure it's not the last we hear of Wynn. I think independents are realizing that having a single voice that echoes their concerns is a powerful thing. And so I think we're going to hear more along these lines in the future. Andrea, I wanted to take a short break to ask about a Music Tech Fest. So what is happening? What is it for people that might not have heard about it before? And what are the events coming up in the next few months?
Okay, well, Music Tech Fest is a festival of music ideas. There's a lot of people, the first mistake they make is they think it's a conference, and it's not. It is very much modeled on the festival of ideas, like the philosophy festivals and the literature festivals, but this is about music and technology and the intersection of those things. So it's everything from academics to artists to record labels to hackers to inventors, all going, look at this thing that I made. I've invented this noisemaker, and let me show you what it does, and does anybody want to play with it? It's 15-minute back-to-back presentations on a dual stage. It's kind of a bit Jules Holland. We hop between the two of them, and we showcase all of these great new ideas, new innovations, new thoughts about music and technology and where those things overlap. And while that's going on, we have a 24-hour hack camp where organizations have put challenges forward, have sponsored hack challenges for people to say, let's team an artist up with a hacker to create something. And it's not just sort of the hacks on screens that you get at a lot of music-style hack events. It's not just about APIs. It's about physical objects in three-dimensional space. It's about people getting away from the laptops. It's about performance and all those sorts of things. And we kind of showcase those on the main stage at the end of that 24-hour hackathon. So essentially, it's a big party that celebrates music and technology and ideas and all those things. It's at the home of the London Symphony Orchestra, actually, in London, at the LSO St. Luke's, which is right on Old Street, you know, Silicon Roundabout, which is really cool. That's the 5th or the 7th of September. Then we're in Berlin at Factory Berlin, which is where Ableton now set up you know, a bunch of other really great tech companies. That's Berlin is end of October. October, then we're at Paris at EarCam in November, we're in New York in December, and then it starts to get busy. We've got 11 Music Tech Fest events scheduled for 2015 all over the world.
Amazing.
And we've turned down more than we've accepted. So we keep getting asked to do them in different places, and of course the big question is right now we need to pay for them.
Yeah.
So we work, because we want to make this is the other thing that's unlike a tech conference, because tech conferences and music industry affairs tend to be really expensive events.
Yeah.
It can be £1,000 for a ticket. And we want to bring in the crowd that can afford maybe 20 quid for a ticket or 10 quid for a ticket. We want the people who are kind of the kids or the innovators or the hackers. And we're working with young people. We're working with all sorts of kind of excluded groups and doing really sort of interesting things around music and technology. So we want to invite those. So we're trying to do it in such a way that we can make it as affordable to everybody. We stream everything online. We record every presentation. We put it all on YouTube. And it's all about kind of getting this stuff out there. And the final piece of the puzzle really is we do a kind of what we call the after party, which is basically an academic symposium on the Monday after the weekend, which a whole lot of people who have been invited, who have been at Music Tech Fest and presenting and reflecting on what goes on, sit in a room and talk about what it all means and try to get something out of it. And we did this at Microsoft Research in Boston when we did Music Tech Fest there earlier in the year, and we came up with a manifesto for the future of music technology research as a result of this. Nancy Baim and Jonathan Stern, who are really kind of highly respected academics in this field, kind of took it upon themselves to curate essentially a manifesto. And there's some really good stuff in there. It's at musictechiefesto.org. Yep. And it's this document that you can sign up to. And it's basically become the charter and the manifesto for the Music Tech Fest sort of movement, if you like. But it brings in all of these different stakeholders for music and technology. And it's a really good place for new collaborations, new experiments. It is totally an experimental and improvisational space, but the stuff that comes out of it's amazing.
Awesome, and that's at musictechfest.org. You can go and check that out. And Eric, on your front, tell us a little bit about what's going on and what your new company is all about.
Well, so it depends who you ask. If you ask my husband, I'm unemployable, but I like to see it as more a kind of entrepreneurial way.
Yes.
Self-unemployed.
Yeah, basically.
That's what I am. That's how it works, yeah.
And it's working well, apart from maybe the hairline for the trip.
Yeah. But,
so I basically decided that I was doing the same thing day in, day out for so long that I just wanted to kind of break out and try and do something a little bit different. So I've decided to go down the consultant route, which is obviously not different in the slightest, but that's so that I can carry on paying my bills.
Yes, sure.
So I'm working with...
you get more variety, though. That's for sure.
Exactly. So I'm working with some rights holders and some digital services at the moment just to kind of help them kind of really work their way through the market, you know, helping rights holders get through some of the backlog of stuff they've got, because I think that's one of the other issues that a lot of people are facing at the moment is there's so many services starting at the moment and yeah. people are kind of drowning in the workload just to try and help navigate it a little bit. But the kind of end goal is I'm working on building a platform with a couple of people to do it's an online working platform to help change the way that the media industry engages with professionals to be able to kind of scale their expertise base on a need-by-need basis. So
I am intrigued.
Yeah, it's going to start to take a bit of shape, but great. Awesome. it's getting there.
Do you have a site yet?
No, at the moment I'm just using mymediainsider.com, which I'm just basically blogging any old crap just to kind of just keep some form of traffic going sure. there. But yes. at the end of the day, it will be mymediainsider.com.
Yeah. Perfect. Awesome. And now let's move on to talk about, I want to talk about radio for a second here, because Andrew, of course, is a real expert in the space of radio. And so I always try and fit in a story about online radio when he's on
That's
the show.
That's very kind of you.
And so, you know, I wanted to talk about Rhapsody's Unradio service. So that's a service that I actually haven't covered on the show quite yet. So, you know, it's not new, but Recode did an interesting piece on it. So I thought it was worth bringing it up. So essentially, you know, Recode talks about the fact that this Unradio service, which essentially is a service that Rhapsody created by partnering with T-Mobile, and which is less expensive than a normal subscription, but still allows some level of offline caching for users. It could be an interesting proposition for consumers that are not prepared to pay $10 a month for the full service, but they do want an internet radio that doesn't have adverts, that allows for some sort of caching, that has a decent breadth of catalog. And so And that's in the context, of course, of us talking a lot on the show about providing alternative models for the music industry that are not the $10 a month and they're not the free, but they're somewhere in between. So this, of course, is presented as a radio in the sense that it is marketed as one, as an unradio. And so, Andrew, from your perspective, is this something that could work? And what do you make of it in the wider context of radio, of course, which you are very keen on as still being seen as a curation platform, of course?
Well, to an extent. I mean, I'm nostalgic about radio, which is kind of counterproductive because I tend to write about, in fact, my book that came out at the end of last year was called Radio in the Digital Age.
Right.
And a lot of that is how is this now configured and what does radio mean? And actually, one of the first things I conclude in the book is that radio, there is no way to define radio. There are no kind of essential characteristics that make something radio. It doesn't have to be live. It doesn't have to be geographically located. It doesn't have to be kind of a continuous stream. You know, all these things, lots of things are being called radio that you could point and say, well, that's not radio. And you'd have a good argument, but there is no one thing that you can say, well, this is one thing that radio must have in order to be called radio. So kind of the flip side of that is you could pretty much call anything you like radio, but
right.
That's not what happens either. And so there are sort of these understandings of you know, if it's music and it's streaming and it's not something that I own, or if it's, you know, these sorts of things, there is kind of a radio-ish element to that.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's really interesting about that is that that's always nationally defined. It's always defined by geographic national boundaries and the legislation that applies to that and where you can receive something. You know, you can't get Pandora in some countries and you can get it in others and those sorts of things. But the idea of localization is something that these sorts of kind of online music streaming services struggle with, because actually here is just a bunch of songs and here is another bunch of songs and it could be a jukebox parked anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
And so there are these kind of interesting dynamics about that, but the what I call the bloom problem, this idea of trying to find a price point that isn't 10 but it isn't zero and it's something that people can afford, what can we give them for that? That's a really tough problem to solve, and I actually wonder if it is the problem to solve, if it's the kind of the make or break thing, because rather than saying, you know, can we get people to pay $10 a month or £10 a month or whatever it might be for a music stream? Is there a way in which you can say, can we make something that's actually worth £10 a month?
Right.
By actually doing things that radio is really good at, by doing things like localization, by doing things like contextualizing, by having somebody goes, you know what, you should listen to the song, it's really good, let me tell you something about it, let me interview the person who made it, those sorts of things that radio is traditionally kind of thought of as being really good at. Nobody who's doing these kind of online music services that are essentially a database in a cupboard are trying to replicate and trying to create value and solve that problem. So, I mean, the kind of the Spotify miracle, if you like, is not about how much gets paid to artists or how much gets paid to record labels,
yeah.
But the fact that most people who are now on Spotify, the 120 quid a month that they're now, 120 quid a year that they're now paying represents a massive increase in their spend on music annually.
Yeah.
And that's amazing. That's a really interesting thing. But that problem of, well, I don't really want to spend 120 quid a month on music, but there might be something that I am, 120 quid a year, but there might be something that I am prepared to spend 10 quid a month on that has that as an element of it. And is there anything, so instead of kind of, can we budget, you know, cut rate this thing,
yeah.
Can we add more value to this? I think that would be a more interesting problem to solve, but that's not what these people have chosen to do, and that's not what you've asked me, but
yeah.
It seems like a Me Too kind of service to me. I mean, it really
yeah.
seems like we'll do that as well, or if there's a way in which we can solve this problem, because when it comes down to it, this is not a technological problem that's been conquered finally.
Yeah.
It is just a bunch of songs and a playlist and a cover that are being streamed in one way or the other, and it doesn't, honestly, if you're listening to a Beyonce single, doesn't really matter who you're getting it from. So it doesn't kind of make that much of a difference.
I mean, I guess like the fascinating thing for me is to see companies like Rhapsody and Slacker, of course. So Slacker have done this actually first. So they were the ones that started by offering streaming service and then a premium radio service, and then it became a fully fledged on-demand streaming service as well. So you have different potential entry points on the price. But I like the idea of companies that have amassed this huge catalog and they have all the rights in place to play with that catalog and try and find different ways to propose it to customers through different channels to figure out if there are pockets of the market that are being left out. In this case, of course, Rhapsody is more of an experiment. You know, Bloom was pointing, you know, putting all of its chips in that particular basket. But I think it's fascinating to see this experiment happening. Eric, what do you make of Rhapsody's move in this case?
Honestly, I don't really get it.
Right.
I just think it's a bit crap.
Love it. It's only $4 a month, though.
Yeah, I think for me...
So it's cheap crap.
Yeah, it's cheap crap. And now, yeah. My people, we're all about the cheap crap. We really are. We're the only ones that still buy Madonna's music, so, you know, I don't know where to go with this. But
I don't know. The bald and bearded, you mean?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
The service as a whole, like, you know, as Andrew's saying, it just doesn't seem kind of like it's trying to break any kind of barriers and do something interesting. Right. It's just very samey. I think, you know, the only thing that I kind of really take away from this that I do think is interesting is it's yet another example of a telco doing something that's hard bundled that doesn't take away your data allowance. You know, for me, the biggest problem that we've always faced is, well, as a kind of connected music market, is that we're bound by the amount of data that a telco tells us we can use a month, or we're bound by incredibly high roaming charges. You know, what would be really interesting to see is if you've got Deutsche Telekom or Telefonica or whoever going, do you know what? I'm going to hard bundle your Spotify or your whatever into this, and I'm not going to charge you when you roam with it either. Now, that's something interesting.
Yeah.
But this as a service, it's just... I don't know. I don't really understand what it's trying to do.
Absolutely.
Sorry, Rhapsody.
I was a positive voice in this. I was. I don't know why, but I felt like I felt good about this story. I don't know why.
It's because Rhapsody's been around for so long. I mean, they're real triers, and I really love that about them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm just going to take a quick break, and I'm going to play a short video that I recorded with the CTO of the company Soundwave. They announced a major new release today, and so I caught up with them. And there's also, if you're watching the video, there's a short demo of how the new app works, so check that out. It's a real pleasure to welcome to the show Aidan Cellini. Hi, Aidan, and thanks for joining us. How's it going?
Hi, Andrea. Thanks for having me. Everything is going very good here at Soundwave.
It's great to have you. And so, essentially, it's almost exactly a year since I did the feature on Soundwave. And so,
yes.
There's some news of the company. But first of all, I wanted to ask you about sort of what the past year has been like, how the platform has grown, and sort of what's been going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a very exciting year here at Soundwave. As you say, we launched about 12 months ago. In those 12 months, our app has been downloaded a million times over Android and iOS. We have people in 190 different countries, and we've tracked over 100 million plays. I mean, so with usage, amount of songs we tracked, everything, we're doing a lot better than we thought we would. So everyone at Soundwave is very happy at the moment.
Absolutely. And so, talking about sort of the engagement figures you've had, so how are you people? How are you seeing people interact with the app up until today?
Yeah, I mean, engagement has been very, very good. We've been tracking it from day one, and we're very happy. I mean, people are using it to track their songs. So you have people who are just interested in knowing what they're listening to themselves. We have a lot of those users. We also have users that are interested in what other people are listening to. So they're coming on every day to take a look, see what their friends are listening to, see what their family are listening to, and to discover new music. So we're finding that we have kind of many different use cases, but a lot of different people using the app in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And so today, of course, we're going to chat about the update to the app that you're rolling out next week, essentially. So tell me a little bit about the background to that. Of course, every time you do a refresh on an app, it's a lot of work, and you need to figure out what your priorities are. So what were you looking at improving about the app?
Of course. So for the first 12 months, we spent a lot of time in the technical smarts. So we wanted to know what people are listening to across all their devices and all the different music players. So we're now tracking on native iPhone, native Android, Spotify, Audio, Deezer, Google Play. And over the 12 months, we've kind of expanded our portfolio and really, really cemented the ability to track all the songs. So, I mean, we've seen people use the app in many different ways, and we've kind of track this over the last 12 months, and using this data, we figured out exactly what people are doing and what people aren't doing on the app. and we push the stuff that they're doing to the front of the app. So essentially what Soundwave is now is it's a place to go to share music and right. to talk about music.
Yeah, sure. And so let's go and have a look at the app. It would be great if you could guide me through some of the new features and sort of tell me about the changes that have been implemented over the last few months.
Absolutely. So the homepage of the app originally 12 months ago was the timeline. The timeline tells you exactly what your friends and family and yourself are listening to. So yeah. you can scroll through the timeline and see exactly what your friends and family are listening to. Again, I mean, this is one of the main pages of the app, but we've tidied it up and we've made it a lot simpler and made the most important features and put them to the forefront.
Yeah.
But I think that the piece we're talking about is definitely groups.
Yeah.
So if you go onto the tab where we have the groups, so I mean, one of the key points of this new app compared to the old app is all about groups. It's all yeah. about creating a group of friends or family. So I can create a group with six of my best friends, and we can go in and talk about music and share music to one another. A perfect example is this group that I'm in with yourself, Andrea, and the title of the group is Best Music to Work To. So I'm listening to music like I always do and any of the music players. I come across a song that I think, yes, Andrea would love this song, and I can share that song straight away into the group. And there are all the songs and all the conversations that people have had about those songs.
That's great. And so, actually, it's interesting because I wanted to ask you, how do you prioritize when you just hit the play button? Which service gets hit first?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you go into one of the groups, I'll show you. So on all the song cards, you have a 30-second clip. So you press the play right. button there, and you get a 30-second clip. So no matter what music player you're using to listen to songs, and you'll always get a 30-second clip. But then if you go into one of the songs,
yeah,
perfect. So here you get the YouTube video. So at the very top, again, no matter what you do, you press the play there, you're going to play the YouTube video of the song. Again, if you like listening to songs on Spotify already or Deezer, you still have it on YouTube. So yeah. you're happy with that. You think it's a good song. You want to actually use your own music listening service. So we now have a deep integration with Spotify already on Deezer. So I don't know, Andrea, are you a Spotify user or audio
yeah.
user?
Spotify, yeah.
So if you're a Spotify user, you simply click on the Spotify button. It opens it up in Spotify and you can consume the song in Spotify.
Oh, perfect.
So essentially what this means is no matter where your friends are listening to music, you can all share music into one place. And no matter where you want to consume the music, you can consume the music in that place as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this is actually going to be an interesting feature because obviously once you set up Soundwave to automatically pull in your information, it becomes, I guess, it became harder to engage people in a conversation around it. But with the messaging app, you can actually create all sorts of different interesting conversations around music. And for example, I'm in a group on WhatsApp where people share what kind of gigs they're going to and that kind of thing. But you can easily foresee people using this to do it and actually share the music by the bands that they're going to see so that people can actually listen to it rather than just reading what bands are going to see.
Exactly. I mean, this app is in beta at the moment and we have around 200 people on it, and the amount of different groups that we've seen being built is amazing. People are creating groups around the band, people are creating groups around an event just like you were talking about, and people are also creating groups around genres. So we have a lot of groups on so rock, and people are inviting their friends when they think they like rock songs. But also you have groups about general music. So I'm in a couple of groups with my friends, and I know we all have different types of music, but it doesn't really matter. So I have a group with the six of them in there, and we just share all the songs that we think each other would like.
Yeah. And another thing that I feel like has changed, but correct me if I'm wrong, beforehand it was kind of hard to find new other people to add to the app, in the sense of discover people in your local area and that kind of thing. Most of the data was anonymized. So has that changed over the course of the year?
Yeah, so I mean, the data is still anonymized, but what we have put into Soundwave now is a recommended section.
Right.
So here you have, instead of having to search for a user through your Facebook friends, through your Twitter friends, or just generally searching for their name, we've done the hard work for you. I think the really smart thing about this recommended section is it gets smarter as you play more music. So if Soundwave realizes that actually you're into Iron Maiden, then it's going to recommend other people that are into Iron Maiden.
Yeah.
If you're into Miley Cyrus, then it's going to recommend people who are into Miley Cyrus. So Soundwave is all about following the right people to find the right music.
Absolutely, and that's great. And so, you know, the app has, I guess by the time this goes live, the app will have hit the App Store internationally. So I guess people can go and download the update and check that out. And it was great chatting today, and look forward to seeing what's going to happen with the company over the next 12 months again.
Excellent. Thanks for your time, Andrea.
And next, I want to talk about SoundCloud. So SoundCloud is having some interesting times lately, and the latest reports, which come from Bloomberg, if I remember correctly, are that the company is closing in on deals with the major labels to license their catalog onto the service, but they are also reportedly giving away an equity stake in the company to the majors, somewhere between 3 and 5% each, and apparently the deal would value SoundCloud between 500 and 600 million, which is a little bit below what the latest valuation was from a VC standpoint, but apparently that's a different one than when you're looking at equity discussions. And majors would, of course, also secure a percentage of future revenues as part of the licensing terms. And so, you know, there's not a lot to go on here, but it definitely marks a huge shift, if this is true, in SoundCloud's strategy. You know, the appearance of millions of tracks of back catalog from majors would significantly alter the service. I wonder how independent labels will take the equity stake idea. I mean, we haven't heard anything from Merlin, so it may well be that they are still negotiating with Merlin around that, on whether indies would get an equity stake as well. And it, of course, it's moving away from the initial idea of the company, which was around music creators. And so, throwing all this into the bucket, what do you make of this story and the evolution that SoundCloud might take if this is all true? Eric, any thoughts on that?
where to begin?
Where to start?
You know, I think SoundCloud is a great service. I love
SoundCloud. We all love it.
I think it's amazing.
that's the premise of all this.
The only people that currently pay SoundCloud are the labels for their professional services. So I don't really understand where the labels are getting this cut of future revenue from, unless SoundCloud have got an actual strategy for monetization going forwards. So when they pull that together, you know, I've heard many, many different rumors about the various strategies they've got for being able to monetize the content. It's going to be interesting to see what their huge user base actually think of it and whether or not they decide that the service is worth sticking around for. But, you know, equity, there's always a huge issue when it comes to this. Spotify went through this minefield, you know, the artist pushback over labels getting a huge amount of equity so that if the service ever flips, you know, the artist don't see the benefit from it, the label does. I think that could be quite a difficult conversation for them to have. So getting the FAC's opinion on this, I think, would be quite interesting.
Yeah.
But also, you know, I think they've built such a good service with a huge amount of traffic. I'm really interested to see if the deals leak, because the past period would kill them on its own. So it's to see with what this equity is doing in terms of past liabilities. And also, going back to our first point, you know, publishing is going to cripple them. Like, because publishers, if you're looking at somebody like PRS in the UK, they can't take equity. So they have a published position on their tariff, and they're constantly talking to SoundCloud about what they're going to do. I just think it's interesting that they're talking to the labels about moving it forwards, but this is just like the first of many, many hurdles that's going to keep smacking them in the face over the next probably kind of 2 or 3 years, because it's not going to go away quickly.
it sounds like an uphill struggle, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's also the nature of the industry. You know, if you have to go retroactively from going to where the service is now to going back and making all the deals, it just becomes such a huge headache than doing it the other way around, where you actually get the deals done first and then you launch a service.
Which is also a headache, to be fair.
Which is also a headache, but at least once you've launched a service, you sort of know where you stand.
I really want them to succeed, though. I really do. Because everything about it is incredible.
I mean, that's the thing. We all love SoundCloud. And every conversation about that is going to start with that caveat. I love SoundCloud. And I think that's the problem that they bought themselves with so much investment and so much pressure to succeed and be powerful.
Right.
And there are all sorts of conversations to be had about the kind of the growth fetish of businesses who want to get this kind of VC money and then want to kind of build up millions of users and millions of kind of equity valuation and then sell it, because really that's the only way to make any money out of it at all, because the revenue is just not going to be there.
Blast FM!
Last FM had all sorts of other problems going for it, and that's another longer conversation for another day. But I think that it's not just the labels who pay for SoundCloud. And I know, as somebody who pays for SoundCloud, I know that to be the case. And I know that my son pays for SoundCloud, and he's an electronic musician, and he puts his stuff up there, and it's all value for him, for the audience that he has to hear his music, to put it out there. And he's not on a label, and he's not, you know, doing anything. So, and there are lots of people like him making dubstep in a bedroom and doing kind of cool stuff and using it in the way that you would use Flickr for images or YouTube for videos. And that's what SoundCloud's really, really good at. But the problem that I have with this, and this is kind of the problem that I have with Spotify as well, this is why I stopped being a Spotify user, is as soon as the equity goes to the major record labels, the underlying principle is that every single artist on that website makes money for the record labels, whether they're signed to them or not. And I have a conceptual problem with that, because a lot of the people who aren't signed to major record labels aren't signed to major record labels because they don't want to be. And the idea that the thing that allows them to not be signed to a major record label is suddenly making money for the major record labels that they have a problem with is a problem. And I think that's a problem for a massive number of people. And to be honest, it's very, very similar to the problem that killed MySpace. And what killed MySpace was not that they weren't very good at marketing, but because they had every freaking band on the planet, but wanted to put advertisement for cheap children's, like suspiciously cheap children's clothing all over it, because that's what they could sell, and nobody could opt out of that advertising. Nobody could choose how the money was being made, by whom, for whom, and in what way. And everybody went, you know what, this is a bit icky. I'm going to go somewhere else, which is less icky, which has actually turned into something that's even more kind of unbelievably icky in the process. And that'll kind of shake out in time, I guess. But but there is this thing of, you know, you have to think about not just, well, we've got all these users and we need all this money and we've got to kind of pay all this back. How are we going to do this? And if you come up with answers that are counter to the culture of the vast majority of the people who use your service, you've got a problem.
Yeah, and the thing is that, like, I've always said that the only way that this would work would be if they adopted a YouTube model where artists can go into the platform and opt in, opt out, decide if they want to monetize. But that also requires the service to have a huge advertising infrastructure behind it, which of course YouTube had because it had Google's advertising infrastructure behind it. But
it's got to be something other than advertising. I mean, the thing I've always loved about Flickr, the thing I loved about SoundCloud was that you give me something for free and that's really cool and that's useful, and the more that I want to use it, the more that I want to go, you know what, I'm going to pay you money so that you solve this problem for me. Why can't that be a business model? Why can't that be the whole story? Why do we need millions and millions and millions of dollars in valuation in order to make something that is sustainable and useful and practical and lots of people can do it? The fact that, okay, well, we need venture capitalists because suddenly we're really important and exciting, and this is something that could have been grown naturally and something that could have,
I mean, look at Mixcloud, that's a different story.
Absolutely. I mean, look at Bandcamp. This is one of these stories where these things are not about, we want to be the biggest, we want to be the most important, we want to be the greatest. You know, we just want to be a good business that makes money, and we want to provide a service that people appreciate. And I don't see what's wrong with that. And I think that's the thing that, you know, I love SoundCloud, but it's let me down.
Yeah. Right. And finally, the last story of the day. Oh, actually, I'm going to... I've done that already. Okay, I'm losing the plot. Finally, the last story of the day. I wanted to talk about Neil Young's Pono before we go. And that's making the headlines today for a couple of different reasons. So first of all, there's a management shakeup as John Hamm, the current CEO, is stepping down and is being replaced by none other than Neil Young himself. So Neil Young as a CEO of a tech company. Very interesting. And additionally, Pono announced striking a partnership with the UK-based B2B music provider Omniphone. So the company will power Pono's high-resolution digital music service, and it seems like a really good decision to lean on a third-party provider, because I guess I was pretty skeptical on the company being able to actually create a whole back-end infrastructure to host and deliver and ingest the high-resolution files. So it makes complete sense for them to lean on a third party that's done this in the past. It's going to be interesting to see how they integrate the catalog that they've already ingested themselves, because as far as I understood, Pono had already done quite a bit of work in sourcing high-res masters from labels. So what was going to happen to that is going to be interesting to see. You know, what do you guys make of this? Neil Young as a CEO of a tech company, and also this decision to outsource their requirements on the technical front. Andrew?
Well, I'm not qualified to evaluate Neil Young's business acumen. I mean, right. It's as simple as that. He might be a very good manager. Who knows? Or he might be one of those CEOs who is the front person of the company and actually their operating officers. Yeah. And, you know, that happens all the time. So as far as, is Neil Young the right person for the job? Mm-hmm. But I don't think anybody else knows either. And, that, you know, and I think the problem with it is that he's a pop star. and that people go, but he's a pop star, he's not a CEO, and it's all gone horribly wrong, and all of this money that I put into this thing that I thought was going to give me nice audio now has a lunatic at the helm, and what are we going to do? Who knows? I mean, it could be something that is sort of, he might prove to be a very good businessman.
Exactly.
I don't know.
Yeah,
But again, even if he does, I'm still not the right person to be able to judge whether that happened or not, because that's not my particular field of expertise. But I think it's a really interesting story when you start to think about what is the Pono story about. It is about this kind of perpetual struggle in music and technology between convenience and quality.
Yeah.
And this perception that what makes for quality is a kind of studio quality resolution of the audio files, getting what the artist intended, overlooking the fact that actually there's a lot of processes that go on in the studio that are about kind of completely subverting what the artist intended. And you know, that's the job of the producer, for goodness sake. So, but all of the kind of the things that stand between the kind of the real performance and, you know, all of the microphones, all of the processing, all of the compression, all of the, you know, those things, those are still going to be there. You're just going to hear them in ultra fine detail. But of course, people are still going to put it on in a room with the window open and trucks going past, or they're going to listen to it on tiny headphones, or, you know, whatever it happens to be. It's not going to be this perfect listening environment that everybody expects. I'm somebody who happens to pay for occasionally for 24-bit audio files, and I'm kind of one of these ECM nerds that likes the kind of very quiet music and very kind of beautiful, pristine stuff. Not for everything. I kind of don't mind a 320k MP3 for a rock record, and I used to be a record producer and a sound engineer. Can't really tell the difference with most types of music. And there are some types of music where that kind of spatial extra quality of a bit becomes really, really important. But that's because I have a home stereo that's worth less than £10,000, and so it's not just the box that you store the things on. It's about what you use to replicate the thing that becomes important. And so, you know, unless you've got the speaker system and the array to support that, I like the intention of it though. I like the idea that this is a format that is all about quality, and we've managed to bundle quality inside convenience. We've solved the problem. And if Super Audio CDs were still with us, or DVD audio, or any of the other sort of high-resolution formats that have been with us, when in actual fact you find that actually the convenient formats like cassette tape are the things that sort of go on to become the big thing of their day, it remains to be seen whether that's going to be useful. And I think that's the interesting conversation is to what extent is the high-fidelity audio the quality that we need, and to what extent is it just, could you just give us lots of really good songs, because actually that's what you're really good at? That would be a kind of a good conversation to have.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, for me, the interesting thing about the fact that they've gone with Omniphone is the fact that my problems with the service were the fact that I couldn't see it become a sustainable service, because they've only sold 15,000 devices, and you know, how big of a music market can you create out of 15,000 people? And even if they become 25 or 30,000, if you have to create the entire backend yourself, if you outsource that, then the overheads become much lower. It may be actually a lot more feasible to create at least a self-preserving, you know, service that may not make a ton of money, but actually is able to survive that way. Eric, what do you think?
I think I couldn't agree more with what you've both said. You know, if you look at it as a separate thing, which is a device, and you're selling a device that gives you quality, and you know, $400 isn't a vast amount of money, although, you know, the majority of people that spend money on music would not spend that much money on a device. But, you know, Apple made a freaking fortune off of selling something that somebody else would put music onto.
Yeah.
So I think that conceivably there is a business there, but it does worry me, the really limited number of people that have actually signed up to it.
You know, although, like to be fair on that point, though, the people who have bought that are likely to spend more money on music
Absolutely.
Than most people who will buy cheap MP3 players.
Yeah. But $25 an album, it's a much higher price point. I don't know. I just think in order to make it really big, then it's kind of missing the mark a bit. But then they potentially don't need to make it really big. You know, if they can build something that's sustainable, I think going back, you know, to the Rhapsody on Radio thing again, it's like you may not need to be doing something that's kind of like groundbreaking in terms of sales, but actually, if you do it really well, it's the Field of Dreams thing. If you build it, they will come.
Like, Absolutely. No, you know, I'm fascinated by the story and I can't wait for the Pono to come out, hopefully by the end of the year or in early 2015 to, you know, see how it works and how people react to it. And that was all for this week's show. We skipped a couple of stories, but there was too much to talk about and we've already gone over our allotted time. But I would like to thank you profusely for taking the time to come on the show today, Andrew and Eric.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andrew. And actually, I should say, because I don't know if people ever do, but thank you so much for doing this, because this is such a valuable thing that you do for the whole music community. It's just,
thank you.
It's such a great thing that exists, and I'm really glad to be part of it. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. And yeah, hopefully, this was the funny stage where I started to get sort of 20, 30 emails from students from all sorts of different courses and universities asking for interviews for the dissertations. I tried to accommodate as many as I could, but it was tough. Thanks so much for your time, and thanks again for listening to the DMT show. You can check out digitalmusictrends.com and follow us on Twitter on @DigiMusicTrends. Have a fantastic week, and until next time.